Expanded Perspectives, Classic Rewind. Hey, everybody, and welcome to Expanded Perspectives, Classic Rewind, the show where we replay or re-air some of our favorite segments and interviews we did in the past because some things deserve a listen to more than once. I'm your host, Kyle Filson, and on today's show, we're going all the way back to December 9th, 2013, when we spoke to Paul Nation about Papua New Guinea's Indaba bird, also known as the ropin. Now, the ropin, or the Indaba bird, means demon flyer in its native language, and is a cryptid thought to be either a large bat, or more commonly, an actual living pterosaur. Now, it's said to produce a light, bioluminescence, possibly to attract fish, and it's known to live in and around the Papua New Guinea area. Now, according to the book Searching for Ropens, that's R-O-P-E-N-S, it is any featherless creature that flies in the Southwest Pacific and has a tail length of more than 25% of its overall wingspan. Now, on the island, the word ropin refers to a large nocturnal creature that glows briefly, they say, as it flies. Now, the ropin is kind of the subject of folklore. It's like a man, and some people say it's almost like a spirit, but it's believed by some natives to be a real living animal. Now, the ropin is believed to be nocturnal, and like I mentioned before, to exhibit this bioluminescence. And it purportedly likes to live on a diet of fish, although there have been some reports of the creature feasting on pets like cats, dogs, and even human flesh. Now, despite popular myth, the ropin itself was not fabricated by creationists. No, it was first sighted by 1935 by famous biologist and entomologist Evelyn Cheeseman, who believed in evolution and was well-respected among the scientific community. Now, our guest today, Paul Nation, since 1994, has made 5 expeditions into the remote jungles of Papua New Guinea to research a phenomenon which has led to video evidence of an unusual animal's existence. Local natives have been observing them, they say, for many years. These unusual flying creatures emit this strange glow, and somehow they've eluded modern efforts to effectively observe or document them. Now, if you want to go over to Paul's website, it's called indavabird.com. That's IndavaBird.com, all one word, which I will also put in the show notes. You can read several eyewitness accounts of this rare, elusive creature. You can also see computer analysis of the videos of the creature's bioluminescence and how it demonstrates that their light is not any type of man-made or artificial light source. He claims that his contacts within Papua New Guinea have recently located another area for further research, and he's going to have to conduct that. This promising area is so remote that the closest native villages are a 4-day hike away from any towns or roads. Well, without further ado, let's get into our interview with Paul Nation and the Indaba bird. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives, Classic Rewind.
Mr. Paul Nation. Paul, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Glad to be here with y'all.
Man, we are excited to talk to you about it. We kind of started out in certain areas, and me and Kyle both got caught up in crypto stuff as we were younger and kind of built up to it. But your crypto animal, everybody has their own crypto animal that they have, but you are the crypto man for the Indaba bird. And I guess, could you explain to everybody, if they don't, we know what it is, and we've kind of told some people what it is, but can you kind of give a quick rundown of what, that way kind of everybody gets on the same page of what it is?
Yeah, the Indaba bird is I guess, my term. This creature, actually we've found probably about 10 different names for it. The most common name on the internet, if you look up, is ropin, mm-hmm. which is the first term we heard back in 1994. Now, some of that ropin has grown just because people have kept repeating, and the information has gotten sort of, not diluted, but expanded, let me call it that way, exaggerated some. So I've been trying to raise funds to go back next year, and so it started to differentiate my research from the Ropin research, which is a lot of just repeating of hearsay, I've decided to call it the Indaba bird. Now, the Indaba is what the locals, the natives, call it in the area where I actually got video of the bioluminescence. Now, if you want to go back into history, I'm thinking, here again, some of this is just off the cuff. I got it on my website, indababird.com. But the first reports I really came across from the Western civilization were back in, I think, 1875. Some British explorers were going up what they call the Baxter River in New Guinea at the time. And a Mr. Smithhurst on the steamer took a shot at a bird, and their description in their writings to the Nature magazine back in 1875, I think it was like in September edition, again, all that's on my website, they said it had a wingspan of about 18 feet.
Wow.
And something that huge, even back then, and you must realize back in 1875, that's only a few years after the first quote-unquote dinosaur was even termed. So they were looking at a real flying bird that had a wingspan of about 18 feet. Now, as he took a shot at it, he missed. And one of the descriptions of this creature was that the wing beats were so loud, it sounded like a steam engine pulling a long train very slow. Now, if you've ever been to Six Flags over Texas there in Arlington, that's about the only steam engine I can relate to.
Yeah.
But I can remember when it first starts coming out of the little terminal loaded with a lot of tourists and people, it chugs along, goes poof, poof, poof. You know, about every second or so, it's got a big puff of noise. Let me call it noise. Now, let's jump up to 1944, and Dwayne Hodgkinson has seen a large flying creature. And again, his description of the wing beats is about 1 second. He said every 1 second, he goes, you know, so here we have two critical examples of the wing beat, how loud and how strong it was, you know, and they're separated by about 70 years. So that, you know, started me as I got to researching this thing, because as I grew up with Tom Slick. I don't know if you ever do any history on Tom Slick. He was a businessman that really was one of the first to start looking for the Yeti or the Abominable Snowman, mm-hmm. or Sasquatch. He put a lot of his own personal money into the research, trying to find out really what was out there. Now, he got killed in a plane crash fairly quick after he started his research, and his money dried up. And we sort of missed that, not having a good Tom Slick, some big, wealthy businessman that can fund a lot of us poor folk out here,
mm-hmm.
you know, trying to fund this on our own. So I grew up with that, and then through my wanderings, I grew up in 1994. I was raising ostriches and emus. I don't know if you know those large, flightless birds.
Yes, sir.
And the man who's heading up the first expedition, after hearing from Dwayne Hodgkinson and his descriptions and his adventure in 1944, Carl Ball from Glen Rose, Texas, was getting together a group of us from Texas, basically, to go and explore an island that he had been over there once before and had pinpointed this island of Umboy was a hot spot for this Ropin creature. So since I could handle a 300-pound bird out in the pasture without getting myself killed, Carl invited me to go along. And, you know, at the time I thought, a living pterosaur or a pterodactyl? Let me go back to the pterodactyl, because everybody knows what a pterodactyl looks like. Now, in the fossil record, a pterodactyl is only actually has about a 3-foot wingspan. It's a fairly small flying creature, because of over in Papua New Guinea, I have picked up flying fox bats that had over 6-foot wingspan just before the folks there, the local natives, wanted to eat them. So they're extremely large bats over there by the hundreds. I mean, I went hunting with a Mr. Cow, K-A-U, from the village of Gomlagon, and he had an old broken shotgun that was so rusted, I was afraid he was going to blow up in his face, but he had one 12-gauge shotgun cartridge, and he put it in there and shot up in a tree and got three bats in one shot.
Wow.
They went around, picked up the bats, and were
skillet shot.
Home. Yeah, gonna cook them and eat them. So, So as this thing progressed from 94, I was invited to go to handle and be the quote-unquote veterinarian technician because I was used to catching the ostriches, and then I was incubating the eggs and raising the chicks and turn around and selling them. So I could handle the incubation of the eggs. So we had funds, and we got permission from the government, and we developed some self-contained incubators to take over. It was a pretty big deal. We were trying to drag 1,000 pounds of equipment through the jungle with us. And we hiked up to the top of Mount Bell, where this thing supposedly had a cave that they had seen and all this. So we chased a lot of bunny trails through that island. And the thing was that the more I saw the nationals and the more I talked to them, the more I came convinced that there is really a large flying creature of some type existing in the world today that we have not cataloged as us Westerners, you know. Now, this is nothing new to the locals. The locals have known about it for hundreds of years. So there again, you got to balance their descriptions to what we have found out of the fossil record, because I guess our best eyewitness descriptions comes from the Dwayne Hodgkinson sighting of 1944, where he describes what we would call a pteranodon, except that it has a long tail, more along the way of a Rhamphorhynchus type dinosaur, pterosaur, I should say. Now, let me back up a little bit and educate a little bit on the pterosaurs. Now, I am by no means an expert in this field. I have learned all this because just of my trudging through the jungle, and then I get back home and I have all these descriptions that have been given to me, and then I just get on basically the internet and research the scientific journals and try to put together. And I have seen so much change in the pterosaur research since 1994 that it's sort of amazing to see what they keep discovering in the fossil record. Now, they basically, the scientists, the paleontologists, have separated the pterosaurs into two families. You have your pterodactyloids and you have your rhamphorhynchoids. But what unique characteristics of this creature, the ropan or the indaba, as I prefer to call it, I think indaba has a little more
mystery sound to it. Yeah. That's the Kyle and I both are like, we like indaba way better than ropan or pterosaur.
Right. So, I mean, that's why once I got to the village of Tawa, and one of my eyewitnesses, Indaba here, I said, hey, I like that. I think that's one of the best names. So that's why I sort of call it the Indaba bird and separate it a little bit from Roland. But in reality, I think they are still the same creature. It's just that in Papua New Guinea, you have over 800 different languages, and each language is sometimes 5 miles apart. I mean, I can climb a mountain ridge and go to the next valley, and the next valley speaks an entirely different language, not just a dialect, a language. So
I guess now for people that don't know, Papua New Guinea is roughly the size of Texas.
Correct. Yeah, it's right north of Australia.
And so, that's a lot of land for it just to be a lot of, and as thick and rough as the country is, that's a lot of area for something to hide.
Yeah, and again, I mean, if we look at the fossil record and we see that the pterosaurs can go either way, this creature actually picks up two characteristics from each family group of the pterodactyloids and the rhamphorhynchoids. And so I'm looking and thinking, I have fossilized bones that we are researching, and these people who are in the bush or in the jungle, they have no education. They have nothing to pull a description from, and yet they're pulling two major descriptions out of each family and combine it to this one bird. You know, that gives me more thought that they're actually seeing something mm-hmm. rather than making it up. So, because, you know, it's hard to go through, because they do tell a lot of stories. They do have a lot of, how should I say this, occult. They're very big into demons and demonic activity, and I have to be careful because, you know, over here in America, we don't think of those terms. Over there, they do. So mm-hmm. I have to sift through sometimes what they give me in descriptions and try to come back to what, okay, they're saying one thing. Am I translating it correctly in my Western mind? and try and put it into the fossil record. But what has given me more confidence is on the last couple trips, I have taken a what I call a flash card of silhouettes. I have a laminated sheet of silhouettes of bird heads, the silhouettes of common birds that they know, like the cats, the kites, like a hawk, eagles, cockatoos, birds that they know of, that I take a few birds from the European continent, and then I take birds from the fossil record. Now, 100% of the people who claim to have seen this Indaba bird will go immediately to the pterosaur silhouettes. Okay? That's 100%. They will totally bypass the modern birds' silhouettes. Now, out of that 100% going to the pterosaur silhouettes, 80%, now to me that's phenomenal, 80% of them will pick out what we call from the fossil record a Pilosis sordis, or Sordis pilosis, actually I think is how they've termed it, which is a type of pterodactyloid that is found, I think, over in Germany is where they have the best fossil record from. But the unique shape of its wing and its head. And so, again, I say, these folks have to see something similar to be able to be so concise in their description. And 80% of these people, now I'm talking maybe out of 25 people, okay? I don't have a massive amount, but out of these 25 people, they go from the island of Amboy to the mainland of Wau and Tawa and Bainu. And so I'm looking at, and I've never done this before, I think about 10 different language groups.
Oh,
so I'm not looking at legends that they get together with the big powwows and share stories. These people, they don't get together as villages and you know, get together. They get together and they have their little wars in which they fight with machetes, and they'll come together until somebody gets hurt bad or killed, and then the war is over with. And, you know, blood has been shed, so the insult or the offense has been taken care of, and they go back to their ways. So they don't get together and share these stories. So I see some main ingredients from each language group, and they tell me these sightings that I think indicate that there is a living creature. I call it a creature because I don't know if it's a pterosaur or not, okay? I'm opened up to say that what if the thing is just a mega bat? Well, that'd be phenomenal. I mean, can you imagine a bat with
something
a
that size? So you've got story collaboration from multiple languages of people that have never and will never meet.
Exactly.
And they see the same thing.
Yeah, that's right. Pretty right
solid,
there to me.
That's pretty solid evidence that something's going on.
I've gone from an island environment. I'm back into the mainland now, back into the bush. If you ever look up on the Papua New Guinea map, I've been going out to Wau, which is in the central highlands. And the last couple of villages I stayed, spent time in, one of the guys who, he's pictured on my website with his family and his clan, and they look pretty modern in a way. They have decent Western shirts on and such. But his dad, in the 1960s, was eaten by the village. You know, that's not too long ago. They were cannibals.
That's not that long ago at all.
Yeah, so his dad was the last person eaten by the village of Bainu. So they've come a long way, just a few, 50 years?
Now, Paul, I had read online. Now, like I said, it's online, so you really can't trust 100% of it. But now that I got you, I can ask you. I had read online of some stories that they had found, while some doing research and expeditions looking for this creature, they had found large, I guess, from jumbo clam shells up on the mountains, and that the villagers were like, yeah, that's what they believe that they eat. But it was the fact that why would anybody go out into the ocean and harvest these clam shells and then carry them to the top of mountains to eat them?
Yeah, see, that I'm not familiar with. Now, I've seen those killer clams. They're called killer clams. You look them up. Remember in the cartoons, you always saw a big old clam and a guy be swimming by this. Well, I have personally picked up a clam a little over 3 foot, just half shell. It's been opened up and eaten. So, you know, I know they get at least 3 foot. They took me to show me one that had been like 10 or 12 foot, but they said it had been moved. You know, again, I've been on these bunny trails, but I think the record is well over 15 foot for the, if I remember doing some research of that killer clam. But again, I picked up one, 3 foot, And there's a whole bunch of them, or not a whole bunch, but several of them that were smaller and 2 foot. Now, one of the guys took me down to the beach one night, or one day we went down with the local village of Opie and did some fishing. And he brought one up that was, I'd say just under a foot. And he pulled them, the muscle out, the meat out, like an oyster, and they cooked that whole thing for everybody. Oh, so, yeah, and that's what they do say, that this creature does love those. But as far as in the mountain, there again, I personally, I'm not saying that it doesn't happen. I have not run across any sightings. All my sightings have been, or all my experience with what I call the killer clam, is down on the beach itself. And I did go to one village called Taraway, and they said they had one way up on the hillside somewhere. But again, once we went to look for it, it had been several years that the guy had been there. And, yeah, you know, I don't mind chasing trails, and I've done my fair share of trails, but I've learned that sometimes they like to tell a good story, and I'm there. So
now
it's fun to go to.
You filmed, didn't you film yourself some bioluminescence?
Yeah, that's really my big claim to fame. It was in 2006. I was up in the Bainu village, and I had seen this bioluminescence several times during my week watching, but I always thought it was so far away that I didn't try to film it, because all I have is just a consumer grade, you know, what I call a mini DVD type tape camera. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think it would show, because it's just I'm sitting up, let me backtrack and sort of set the scene. I'm sitting up on a high garden site, which is right at 8,000 feet. I know it sounds like a high garden site, but I'm actually in a cloud forest. You have your rainforest, and then they also have a term for a cloud forest, which is like above 5,000 feet. There's so much humidity and moisture that it turns back into a jungle setting. There's a lot of moss hanging on everything, and everything just gets saturated because the clouds would come in, and they'll just sit in the area for days, and you don't get much drying. And you're up high, and it's cold and chilly. But I'm able to overlook a river valley below me. Now, I never saw the river because of the trees, but I'm sitting from one ridge. And if you ever research in the jungle, one of the hardest things to do is find a clear area to see very far. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, all you can see is maybe 150, 200 feet away from you before the dense canopies just cover you in. And so something could fly over you and you could never see it, because the tree canopy is about like three levels of canopy, and the tallest one is sometimes 120 foot off the floor. So I was able to get up onto this garden site where this man Zion had put his garden, and he had three huts up there, and they were nice enough to really take good care of me for the week I was up, because I'd sleep in the daytime and stay awake at night looking for this bioluminescence. And I'd start seeing this bioluminescence coming down the river valley. And I'm probably saying it's a mile, maybe a mile and a half away. And it's below me. I'm right at 8,000 feet above sea level. And this thing's coming down. And one of the most dramatic sightings I saw one night is as it came following the river valley below me, all of a sudden it started gaining altitude. And right across from my observation point was a small mountain they call Hamya, and the mountain was more of a rectangular shaped mountain, sort of narrow and sort of long. I mean, I'm talking maybe a quarter mile long, not a really big mountain. I don't know the term, but on the one end of this mountain was a sheer rock promontory, I call it a peak, just sheer rock, no trees, nothing, for 50 feet before you got to the tree line of the jungle back again. And this thing started angling up, flying up toward this rocky point, and then just about 50 feet from the rocky point where I thought, hey, I'm going to be able to see some reflective light off the rock or whatever, the luminescence just dies. It shuts down entirely right in front of me. And I thought, So, but for several nights, I'd see this luminescence flying up and down the river valley, and I saw it going away from me a couple times, because I was told when I first got the point that I would not be able to see any civilization whatsoever. Now, I was able to, at my elevation, to look over, and I could actually see a car coming into a Siki Valley 20 miles away. And I'll have to say that at one time I considered that to be some of this bioluminescence. But my second trip, I took some better binoculars, and as I was looking at it, because it was just too precise, every night I could pick up about 720, I could see this bioluminescence. Well, it was not a bioluminescence. It was artificial light. And I was able to determine the difference between that artificial light at 20 miles away as compared to what the bioluminescence I was seeing right within a mile or so.
So when you saw it in the river bottom, you knew instantly that that wasn't somebody with a spotlight, or wasn't a car, or wasn't a boat, or anything like that. Instantly, it was something
right.
that doesn't
even
belong.
An airplane. Yeah, it was. I'm a licensed helicopter mechanic from many years ago. I'm a private pilot. I'm used to aircraft and the sounds they make, and you know, I love that, and you know, that's been part of my education for many, many years. And this luminescence, one thing that struck me since 1994, when they talk about this bioluminescence, the biggest thing I always say is bright light, bright light. Well, I want to tell you a bright light. Now, what in your mind would be a bright light? Would it be a mag flashlight? Would it be a 100-watt light bulb? Or would it be a million candle power, you know?
Yeah,
it's handheld.
Changes for everyone.
Yeah, this is bright light, bright light. But the first time I saw that luminescence, it is bright. I mean, it boggles the mind what can generate that much candle power. I mean, really. I mean, you stop and think about it. Because I can see it, and I'm gazing. Now, you have to understand, too, it's hard to gauge distance of light at night. So mm-hmm. I'm going to, you know, waffle back and forth. But to me, it looked like over the river valley, and I was sitting back up a ridge. I figured straight shot about a mile from the center of the river. So that's why I'm using a mile or so. But I won't argue with people who say, well, you can't see that or don't know the difference. I understand that because it's a bright light and a black background. Because there's no other artificial light in this whole area. Now, the locals, the natives, do have some flashlights. They do have some pretty powerful handheld flashlights, which I have seen, and I can differentiate the difference between those two. But this thing is just a round orb, you know. And when I started researching some more and talking to some of the old people that have been around, Australians who were there in the 40s and 50s, after World War II, and up to the late 60s, they mentioned a lot of UFO activity, which, if I had not known of the Ndaba bird and its characteristics, I would have said that was a quote-unquote UFO, which, what is a UFO? Unidentified flying object.
The Ndaba bird fits right in there.
Exactly, yeah. So, the strange thing is, it's the bioluminescence that it can generate. And as I try to trace that down, I've talked to eyewitnesses who said it's the tail that is generating the bioluminescence. And then I've talked to others who said it's also the chest area that can generate its bioluminescence. And after seeing it, I'm going to say the whole thing can generate its bioluminescence, which until we get into the ocean. Hey, which brings up a point. Did you see that glowing creature that was in the river over there in London yesterday?
Yeah, we saw that posted online.
Yeah, I don't know if it was a squid or an octopus or something.
But did you see how bright it was?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought it was somebody shining a spotlight on something.
That is exactly almost the intensity that I could witness.
And then you saw it just shut off. It just went, yeah. when he was done glowing. That is, yeah. That's so wild.
It is. And so when I saw that on the internet yesterday, I got goosebumps because I said, well, that thing's underwater. And
you're like,
mine
there
is
it
in is. The air. You know, so, yeah. Again, I don't want to say that, you know, it's a pterodactyl or it's a rhamphorhynchus or it's a pterosaur, you know, whatever. I'm open to it. It's flying. I think it's definitely a living creature. I don't think it's any type of UFO from another world. Because of natives, when I sit down and they give me descriptions, I can take their descriptions and I can take it and translate it to what we know from the fossil record. So I'm still open to it being an entirely new species, but really, when I get down to it, I think they're describing to me an ancient pterosaur of a type.
Do you have any theories of why it would need bioluminescence? I mean, what would benefit it from that if it was just going to swoop down and get fish or things like that?
Well, speaking of hunting,
maybe
fish,
it sits on top of the water and attracts them when it glows.
Exactly. They talk about it hovering above the water as it glows. And as the fish are attracted, it'll drop down and grab a fish and take off.
Gotcha.
So it could be an attractant, you know, for prey. And most times I've heard of the bioluminescence is it will come into a hunting camp. And I've heard of this twice. I shouldn't say it's a big long time because, again, I'm looking at a very narrow group of people. I don't have hundreds of people talking to me, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm very narrow. And twice I've had hunting parties or people who were at the hunting party when they got a pig. And as they gutted the pig, this creature would come in at night. So it seems to be a carnivorous and maybe a scavenger. And it would sit on a tree limb or a tree trunk, which, again, let me back up before I finish my story. One of the most interesting eyewitnesses I had, it was in the camp of Garu. And some guys were trying to show us how it landed on the tree trunk rather than a tree limb. Again, a bat. We're always accused of this being a bat. Well, a bat, when it lands on a tree, it lands on a tree limb, hits the limb, the tree will start swaying, because when it hits the limbs, it grabs the limbs and swings upside down immediately. A bat never lands upright. A bat will hit the limb and hang down. I mean, I don't think a bat can even stand upright on a limb, just to wait on the bone and tendon structure of its feet. Its feet are made to hang off the limb, and then they almost close onto the limb, and the bat has to actually release his tendons to release from the limb. So a bat will hit the tree and swing, and it'll hang upside down. This creature, they were showing me, hangs onto the tree trunk with both feet and both hands. Okay, what other bird that flies has hands, quote unquote? Only a bat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but yet, for the fossil record, the pterosaurs, again, it's called winged flyer. Pterodactyl means winged fingered. And they have three fingers on each wing, and the fourth finger extends out and takes the membrane to make the flying surface. So these guys were talking about that, how it can land on a tree trunk, hang on with both hands and both feet, and we'll look at them. And as it gets on the limbs, it'll also sit on a limb, and it will flash as tremendous bright light for sometimes 5 seconds, and then dims back down. Again, these people are so into the occult and are so used to witch doctors and demons and such in their culture that this has the effect of paralyzing them. They are so terrified that this thing can flash bright lights, and then it'll swoop down, grab some of the leftover guts from the gut pile, and take off. And then it's when its presence has left them, they come back to normal, and they are just terrified. And again, I heard that twice. So this creature can generate its bioluminescence for hunting, attraction, or it can do it as a territorial defense. You know, say, hey, you're in my territory, and this is it. And otherwise, you know, those are two major parts that birds will do a lot with their plumage that we know about, you know, in order to attract a mate.
It's funny that you bring up the whole thing with them being really into the spiritual side and the demons, because reading on your website, when you're talking about how long it took them for them to warm up to a white man over there, because they were told, they always tell the youth that the white man will take them and eat them. So it's you know, so you can really tell it's really one of those cultures. I mean, they're really into those things. So yeah, I mean, I'm sure anything out of the ordinary like that would, even if it was some form of a large bat, would scare the hell plumb out of them.
Well, I was at a village of the Tanaku, and we were at a quote-unquote trial. Now, again, we have to be careful because my buddy who's with me, he's been over here for 40 years. He's a local legend, but he's a white man too, but they know him. And when he brings the stranger in, we create a circus environment. And so as we were walking through this one village we had landed at, he was bringing some supplies in, some food and stuff to them. We happened to see a big congregation of people, and we found out after we left that the guy in the center of the group of about 50 people was accused of killing his wife. Now, that doesn't sound that unusual. I mean, murder's murder, okay? But the way he killed his wife is he was fishing up the river, and an eel came up at him. And so the eel was coming to him, and he took his machete and sliced the eel across the head and killed the eel. Well, when he gets back to his village, his wife has been killed by a machete slash across the head. Now, they know that people can turn themselves into animals, and sometimes they can present their spirit into this animal, and this animal can do amazing things, can go in and see things and hear things and in that animal shape. And so he was on trial for his life for killing his wife when she was into this eel's body. And that was in 2007.
Yeah, that's not long ago at all. You got to tread lightly over there. You got to be careful.
Yeah, you do. I mean, I've had a few times that I felt a little, I had crossed the line culturally, and I had come back, and we kept moving. You know, we just didn't stay in that area. Yeah.
Now, Cal and I watched a Monster Quest video where they were doing some study over there in New Guinea, and there was a fellow on there named Garth Gussman.
Yeah, Gussman. He's out of California. Yeah, he's a firefighter.
He says that he's seen it, I guess, during the day.
Yeah, he said he saw like seven of them at one time in the air.
Well,
it seems like more of them are seen at night, though.
Now, I'll say this about Garth. We're buddies. We're friends. But he has not seen them in Papua New Guinea, okay?
Okay.
Now, they sort of cut him out. I won't tell you where he's been seeing
his. So it's the magic of editing. Like,
right, yeah. His is in another country entirely.
And, okay.
So I don't want to speak out of turn. I know a little bit about it, and I was felt like I was – it was a bad way of illustrating things. And so, yeah, Garth is his research and is in a different continent entirely. He's not over there.
So they kind of snuck that one in on us.
Well, they had invited me and wanted me to lead the trip, but I was working in Iraq at the time. And I happened to come home for 2 weeks of R&R, and they sent the people down. And I had fun 2 days talking to them. And Garth went ahead and took them to a new area that we didn't know about. And they weren't very successful there. But that's the problem with some of these big TV shows. Even with what's that, Destination Truth?
Mm-hmm.
They approached me too. And they're so limited on their funding that they need to go in and they're just interested in getting show tape. You know, they just want to get things that will make an interesting 30-minute program or hour program, and then they've got to run and do something else. They can't stay for days on end. You know, they can designate. I know Destination Truth wanted to spend 2 days looking for art, and they've got a lot of money to fly in and do stuff. But I think in something like this, you know, I've spent total of 4 months, if I can put them all back to back, since 1994. A little over 4 months. And most of that time, I'd say 95% of that time, is sitting and seeing nothing, okay?
Right. Just like you're hunting. You know, I'm just hunting over there.
I was hours and hours of looking into the sky, trying to see something. So that's what it's going to take is to get back over there. Now, I got excited. I had some new information from a place that I like to go do some research. But it's almost 300 miles from where I've been doing research in the village of Tawa in Manu. But this one came, I think, from a very interesting source, and it sounds like it's got some good potential. But it's like a 4-day hike to the nearest village. And to me, hiking, I'll never be in the shape they are. They grew in that territory. So I figure a 4-day hike for them would be like a week-long hike for me. So,
right.
That's always on the back burner, trying to get some funding to go, because that one's going to need like a 2-month expedition to be able to take the time and to find the people. And one thing I did find out, that each time I go, I learn more of their culture, more of their traditions, and more of their ways of working with the people. And one thing I have to be very sensitive of is when a white man shows up, they are very sensitive that we call them primitive. You know, if we start talking demons and stuff like that, they clam up entirely because they think if they start talking weird things like that, we look down on them. We think they're so primitive that they believe in that stuff. So I have to build up a rapport with them, and sometimes that takes a week sometimes in the village, just sitting and talking about things of the U.S. and whatever, and letting them see that, you know, I'm not in there and out trying to just take whatever, because they're very sensitive about white people coming in and stealing stuff. Now, I was still accused. I went back to the island of Envoy after 8 years, and Mark Cowell, the first thing he asked me is, what took you so long to come back? And they thought we had found gold and silver and diamonds up on Mount Bell. And they couldn't understand why we didn't come back for it. And I said, well, how did you hear that? We didn't find anything like that up there. But they think that a white prospector, that's what we are, they never believe our stories of this bird. They think we're out there and we're looking for gold all the time. And there is a lot of gold in that area. I have personally seen some good spots that I would like to go back and pan for gold, because picking up a handful of black sand, there's gold specks in it, and some of the best gold mines in the world are still around. Wow, Papua New Guinea and Malolo, Papua New Guinea. And so I have to be very careful to say, no, I'm not a geologist. I'm here looking for a bird and stuff like that. And that takes several days of them to see that, hey, I'm not out there looking for gold. And you got to build up some sort of rapport with them to see that, you know, I'm just a common, ordinary man. And I found out the last two trips I've gone by myself. And that has opened up more doors, because as a single guy, one trip I did, third trip before, I took the son with me. And this father-son, it opens up some doors too. But the first trip, there's like eight of us from the mainland and six of us from the U.S. And they just saw money every time we showed up. You know, it looked like we were just loaded, so when I go in slowly and by myself, I have more opportunities that I don't create such a circus environment. But like you said, you know, that's what I have had kids as late as 2007. When I go to the village, if they're below the age of 5 years old, I've had them just scream in terror when they're
really
siblings trying to bring them up to me. Because I'm still probably the only white guy they've seen, and I'm about a foot taller than them and about 100 pounds heavier than them. And so these kids think, oh, I'm going to have them for dinner. So,
hey, Paul, Paul, let me ask you something. Now, with all the different people and the tribal members that you've talked to from the various different clans, are there certain regions to Papua New Guinea that these things are seen? I mean, are they like more prevalent in the highlands you were talking about, or are they down by the coast and like the delta areas, or are they seen all over?
Well, it seems to be most of my sightings would actually be, I've had more eyewitnesses say it's along the coastline. Now, the coastline is so long that I've chosen to go back to some specific areas back in the mainland, like in the Central Highlands where I'm working now, is because I think I need to find their nesting area, you know, an area that they have to create a local nesting area, rather than if they're like the Mexican flying bat that's in Carlsbad Caverns. Those bats from Carlsbad Caverns will fly 200 miles a night or better to fly in mosquitoes. So if this thing is flying as huge as it is, if it flies 200 miles a night, it can cover lots of territory. So I'm trying to find an area where has its nesting area.
And, well, right. That's why I was asking that. I was going to say, you know, do the natives or the indigenous people have any idea of where these things actually live? Like, are they in caves, or are they erecting some kind of giant nest? Do they roost in trees like turkeys, or do they not have a clue?
There's two aspects to it. The most common one is they live in caves. Now, that island of Envoy that we went to in 1994, that seemed to be the most common aspect of it. And then in 1980 some odd, there was a massive earthquake hit this island. And the reason I know about the earthquake is I happened to run across a grass hut. Now, they build them up in stilts, but this grass hut was sitting in the ground. And I asked them what was special about that grass hut and why nobody's in it. Well, they said that was one of the last ones from the earthquake. as it fell down to the ground, they just never rebuilt it. And so it seems like after that earthquake on Umbo Island, which was like 8 point some odd on the Richter scale, it was a massive thing, but nobody got killed because there's actually no structures to fall on. When their huts just fell down to the ground off the stilts, they just walked through the walls because it was just bamboo. And so they're very limited on the injuries, so it didn't make any national attention, or they didn't have any trauma there. But it seemed like after that time, there was less and less sightings. And so if these birds or creatures were inside caves and the earthquake had captured them and actually collapsed their caves, that would cause a lot of the sightings to go down.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So, now, the only thing is, they've told us when we went to Umbo in 94 that Mount Bell is the tallest mountain on the island. It's a little over 5,000 feet above sea level, which is like maybe 10 miles inland, so it gains elevation really fast, that they see it always flying to Mount Bell. So they had a tribal story that there was a cave up there. So we paid like $1,000 American to go up there for a week in 94, and we looked all over Mount Bell. We never found a cave. In fact, the rock geologically would not be suitable for any type of cave on it. It's more or less of a, what I call a dirt mountain, a lot of trees and a lot of loose dirt on it. We were camping up there and we could hear trees falling in the middle of the night during rainstorms. And that was a little spooky because you didn't know how sturdy the trees were next to you.
No kidding.
Now, years later, I can remember an incident on top of Mount Bell. Now, when you go to top of Mount Bell, the trees disappear. The last, 50-foot climb is just tall grass because we're above the tree line for that mountain. And as we were climbing on the top of this mountain, it's not a steep peak. It's probably, you know, 5 or 6 acres of semi-plateau-type grasslands. We came across a nesting area where something large had curled up and had made a nest, you know, just in tall grass. You mm-hmm. know, you've seen a dog turn around and roll around and lay down in grass
mm-hmm.
or in hay if you're on the farm. Well, that's what it reminded us of, was something like that. And we're sitting up there, we're thinking, we're at 2 miles above, and it's getting fairly chilly up here. It gets down in the lower 50s at nights. And what made this nest? Was it a pig? And we ruled out pig because there's no rootings. There's no torn-up soil, you know. Well, what a python. They had a python on the mountain they had thought was about, or many pythons. But then we thought, that's cold-blooded. What would a python be doing up here? And we really had no idea what was making that bed up there. And years later, I got to thinking, you know, if the bird, I'll call it the bird, flies up there, Frozen flies up there, the Indama flies up there, and it lands out of tall grass, that would be a perfect place for it just to bed down for a night. Because many times they see it flying up there the night, and then it leaves the next night. And I thought, if we had really known more about what we were looking for, we might have done more research on that area. Could have been possibly a little nesting area for the Indaba that we bypassed, because we'd only been on the island for 3 days before we went straight to the mountaintop. So I thought years later, when I was reviewing some of the old tapes I had taken, I came across this as we're sitting around looking at this pile of laid down grass and trying to decide what made this. So that was something I think, you know, back years ago could have been a possible opportunity that we did not recognize at the time.
Gotcha. Now, Paul, when are you trying to get back over there and do it again?
Well, theoretically, I'm trying to put together something like in September of this next month, or next year, mm-hmm. 2014. I tried last September to raise some money through Kickstarter and stuff and was unsuccessful. But I've already got about a couple thousand dollars put toward it. And I've got a couple of funders that had helped me in my last three trips that are trying to push me to go back again. So I'm trying to maybe put together something. I'm really looking to it in September. The reason I say September is that's the beginning of the springtime over there. And I've had most of my sightings, most of my activities has been in October. In fact, 2006, I was in there October, November, and that's when I had all my video capture. Mm-hmm. And I went back to the same area in 2007 and for a month and had absolutely zero sightings of any type of bioluminescence. So I'm trying to, you know, shoot for September. The weather is semi, a little bit better. Now, this is a rainforest, so you get over 500 inches of rain a year. So you live with rain and the mud. But it seems like the weather calms down just a little bit more dryness, if you want to call it, with not so many monsoons in September and October. So that'll give me time to try to see if I can get some more interest into funding and going over there for, I'd like to go for 2 months next time. That takes a little bit more money. I've been going a month at a time because a month at a time runs me about $6,000 to $8,000.
Yeah. Now, if the listeners wanted to help you out and do all that, where can they jump on to find you at?
They can go to endowedbird.com and contact me through that and just put, you know, post on there and I'll get back with them or whatever.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives Classic Rewind. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Paul Nation as much as we did. It's a fascinating subject. I know the audio wasn't that great. You've got to remember this comes back all the way from December 2013. We didn't really know what we were doing back then. We didn't have top-of-the-line equipment back then. We were rookies. So I know it doesn't sound as good as today, but the content is there. It's still very interesting. I'd like to believe, I know it's probably not there, but in my mind and in my heart and my soul, I like to believe, I want to believe that there's still some giant pterosaur-like creature living in the remote jungles of Papua New Guinea. I don't know why. It just sounds cool. I don't ever want to go there. I'm freaked out by spiders. I'm freaked out by giant snakes and all the other insects that they're in there and around there that could probably kill you. So I'm never going to go there, but I like the idea of knowing they're there. You know, it's like Mukele Mbembe. I would like to believe that there's still a living Brachiosaurus living in the jungles of the Congo. I know Luke would too, and hopefully y'all do too. Thanks for supporting our show. If you want to help us out, the best way to do that is to share the show with others, friends, coworkers, stuff like that. That really helps. Rate and write us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to the show. Also, you can help us out by signing up for Expanded Perspectives Elite. Just go to the website, expandedperspectives.com, click on the Elite tab, or you can just go to expandedperspectives.com/elite/, and signing up is easy. It's $5 a month, and you'll get access to our entire back catalog as well as extra content every month. And that's the best way to help us out. It helps us, you know, keep getting the resource materials we need to create the show and to keep all this stuff going in. Like I said, to buy audio equipment. Much better than what we had when we started and did this original interview. Because stuff doesn't last. They don't really build things to last anymore. Things are temporary. So you can buy a really good setup and, you know, within 8 or 9 months, it almost doesn't work anymore. It's crazy. I hope everybody out there has a good week. Good week at work. Be safe. Keep your distance. Till next time, I'm Kyle. Peace.